So I'll tell you a little bit about some recent experiments and some experiments that are coming up about studying new physics with nuclear spins, maybe specific emphasis on dark matter and electric dipole moments, but we can talk about some other things too. Okay, so new physics with nuclear spins, there's sort of a fairly large range of new physics scenarios that couple to spin, ranging from CP violation tests, sort of largely motivated by questions about baryogenesis, tree level couplings to a new pseudoscalar boson, like a Goldstone boson, would couple to nuclear spin, which could be an indication of new high energy symmetries. And you can do various other tests of the sort of symmetries of the standard model. A reason to do them using nuclear spins is that you can prepare sort of extremely highly coherent states with, you know, as many as 10 to the 20 particles in the state, and with lifetimes of, you know, several hours, and or even people have even managed days. So, you know, coupling these sort of very highly coherent nuclear spin systems with combining that with sort of with very low noise magnetometer readouts makes these extremely sensitive. The goal basically is to measure the energy difference between a spin up and spin down nucleus, which is the leading order term, of course, is the magnetic interactions of the magnetic moment of the nuclei. But if there's a beyond the standard model term, you would be sensitive to that as well. And this sort of system actually has the best absolute sensitivity to date of the energy splitting between quantum states. You know, atomic clocks are very famous. They have the best fractional uncertainty, but they're measuring, you know, energy splittings that start at sort of in 10 to the 18 hertz or something. So the absolute sensitivity of these nuclear spin systems is much greater than what can be reached with an atomic clock. And in general, if you're looking for a beyond the standard model term, you're looking for a new term added to the Hamiltonian. So your absolute sensitivity is sort of the most relevant. So typically your magnetic field stabilities, maybe you can manage 10 to the minus four or something like that. And so realistically, you need to be comparing two different nuclear spin ensembles, because otherwise fluctuations in this leading order standard model term would simply swamp whatever you were trying to extract from the beyond the standard model physics. And there's a variety of different implementations that people have developed to do that comparison. So how do you really...
That last point, when you say ensemble, basically I make 100 buckets of atoms, measure it, and then look at the... How do I find the BSM effect?
So there are a bunch of different ways that people have done this comparison. The main point is that you always have to have at least two distinct ensembles of the nuclear spins, or of the nuclear spins and electron spins or whatever, because otherwise the magnetic, like the drifts in the magnetic term are just too large. So the experiments I'll talk about here have two different nuclear spin species. I'll be talking mostly about helium and xenon combined, but also helium and neon. People also do it by having the two ensembles sort of very close to each other, but next to each other.
Rows down, ensemble one, rows ensemble two.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, so how do you generate these very large coherent ensembles? In fact, there's a little bit of a tension in this, because in general, if you have a very long lifetime, typically that means you're well isolated from the environment. And so then the question is, of course, how can you control that system that's sort of well isolated from the environment? And the trick that comes into play for the experiments that I'm talking about is optical pumping. And in the specific cases I'm talking about, it'll be spin exchange optical pumping. So point here is that you can transfer angular momentum to the nuclei from a circularly polarized laser via some electrons that are in the same chamber as your nuclei, and then onto the nuclear spins. So basically how this works. So this is now looking at sort of, you have some alkali metal vapor in your cell. So you just go back a second. We have a measurement chamber that contains our nuclear spins of interest, perhaps helium-3 and xenon-129, for instance, and we're polarizing it via a co-located alkali metal, like probably rubidium or potassium. Now, the alkali metal, you can spin polarize the electron in the alkali metal. These alkali metals are effectively hydrogen-like. They have a single valence electron whose, and importantly, these transitions are, you know, at wavelengths where there's where there are good lasers. So if you have this is a simplified energy diagram, but if you have a circularly polarized laser, the photons have spin one. And so by the angular momentum selection rules, you can only excite from, say, the spin is the electron spin minus one half to the MJ plus one half state is the only one that can absorb one of these photons. And then, you know, you have a 50-50 chance of decaying back to the electron spin up state or the electron spin down state. If you decay to the electron spin down state, you absorb another photon. And so it takes two photons to polarize one electron. And roughly speaking, as long as you get all of these rates correct, you can generate sort of completely polarized electron spins. Then when one of these alkali atoms collides with one of the noble gases in the gas, there's some cross-section, which again, the angular momentum conservation allows a spin flip of the rubidium spin and a spin flip of the nucleus. There's some cross-section for that. And again, if you get all your rates correct, you can generate a large spin polarization of the noble gas nuclei. And here it's really helpful that the noble gas nuclei have a very long lifetime. And so you can build up the spin polarization over a long time period. Helium-3, for instance, you probably are doing this for several hours until you've generated a large helium-3 polarization. One thing that makes this a little bit tricky is, so this is a diagram of the rubidium electron wave function. And you see that the rubidium electron, unsurprisingly, has a higher probability of existing at the point of the nucleus because of the positive charge of the nuclei. And that is significantly larger for xenon, which is much more positively charged than the helium-3. So that difference in rates actually makes it difficult to simultaneously polarize xenon and helium optimally.
What about the reverse process where the helium, you know, gives it spin back to rubidium?
Yeah, that's a very good point. That would sort of significantly reduce the lifetimes a priori. So there's two. The main point is that when you do the experiment, you can freeze the rubidium. So the rubidium melts at 65 degrees. Yeah, it melts at 65 degrees Celsius and has an appreciable vapor pressure. Sort of, you're usually talking 100 degrees C to 120. And so in the concept that I'll describe, we'll just freeze the rubidium. So these interactions will go away during the measurement period. Other experiments, people have sort of done the polarization in one chamber and then transferred the nuclei out of it to get rid of the rubidium. But yes, you definitely need to get rid of the rubidium before you try to do a precision measurement, because otherwise this interaction also produces frequency shifts and so on and depolarizes the nuclei. Okay, so a lot of the work of getting all these rates correct, in particular when you have like the large xenon cross section, have been developed over like the past 20 or 30 years actually for medical imaging applications. So it turns out you can polarize a bag of xenon-129, and if you breathe it in, the xenon-129 can cross the lung blood barrier, maintaining its spin polarization, and then maintain its spin polarization in your blood as it travels, you know, to your extremities and back. And so people can use that to study blood flow. In fact, you know, maybe early signs of Alzheimer's or something are restricted blood flow in the brain and so on. This image here is somebody imaging somebody's lungs, which again, MRI can't image lungs because there's no water in your lungs. But if you inhale one of these balloons full of hyperpolarized gas, you can image those nuclei. And so in this particular case, they're looking for COPD, which is a kind of like chronic lung disease.
And helium is better than xenon, it looks like.
That's right. Helium is better. Helium is better than xenon.
Then what does the WEMPF mean?
That's going to be whatever medical thing they're trying to see. but I'm not sure what the abbreviation is standing for. Some part of the lung that's not like, you see, you can't see that part of the lung. So there's somehow the lung is collapsed in that part, the bronchioli are damaged. That's right. So the point of this is people are trying to get the xenon 129 polarizations to work as well as the helium-3, which is hard because of the reverse interaction of rubidium and xenon is too large. However, you know, helium-3 is very expensive and quite rare, and it's sort of like, you know, being managed by the DOE, who can have some helium-3 and so on. So if you can get the xenon 129 to work, that's a sort of abundant and fairly inexpensive. So there's a large sort of medical desire to get that working. And in particular, people have developed sort of extremely high powered, very narrow lasers, largely for the goal of getting the xenon to work. And so we can sort of take advantage of that to try to get a sort of a large population of xenon mixed with helium. But these are now sort of commercially available. Okay, so once you have this, we assume we have this large population of helium-3 nuclei polarized and xenon 129 nuclei polarized. We then, they're sort of aligned along the laser axis. We then transfer both ensembles to the spin-up, spin-down superposition, which processes around whatever magnetic field we have. This is an example. In this experiment, I actually had helium, neon, and xenon. And so this pulse shape is designed to transfer all three ensembles, which have different gyromagnetic ratios, transfer all three of them to the spin-up, spin-down superposition. And this will be important later. Okay, then you just measure the precession frequency of those of the two or three nuclei. And since they're processing at different frequencies, you can extract the different signals in data processing.
Are you ever limited by your knowledge of the magnetic moments? Because you cancel out the B field, right? You measure the
That's right. So currently the measurement of those gyromagnetic ratios is good enough that it is not a problem, but we probably would have to measure that better in order to make big improvements. It's right now it's known to like 5 decimal points or something like that. It's improving sort of continuously. People update the measurement, you know, sort of when needed.
But that determines how well you can.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's a sort of a wide range of new physics that can be studied using nuclear spins, you know, ranging from the very nice asymmetry and looking for CP violation. There are, of course, puzzles in combining gravity and quantum mechanics, which may have, there may be clues to that in testing Lorentz symmetry. New high energy symmetries would produce could produce Goldstone boson relics, which would show up as a new spin coupled interaction. And then I'll talk a bit more about this, but if these Goldstone boson relics make up a significant fraction of the dark matter, you could detect them using an experiment along these lines. This is particularly suited to sort of very low mass axions where the Compton frequency is low enough that we can measure them in these experiments. Okay, so fuzzy dark matter, you guys probably have heard of it. Basically, you know, the lower limit on the possible dark matter mass is sort of set by these dwarf galaxies. And perhaps if your dark matter has that mass, maybe it changes certain certain bits of astrophysics that could potentially be observed. I definitely think one reason that astronomers really like it is that you might be able to see some quantum weirdness in sort of actual astrophysical observations, like the. Sure. Well, no, but people say that you could have tunneling of them between the potentials of the different galaxies.
I don't want to get the command there.
You think so?
It's definitely in the field, but it's away, but it's all classical.
Okay, I thought people were saying that there could be these tunneling effects, but maybe not. I'm not super up to date. And is there a classical version of tunneling? Yes, there. I guess there could be. I mean, yeah, but I guess there could be if you can have an evanescent wave in classical mechanics too. Okay, so searching for the dark matter using an experiment like this. If these axion waves are the dark matter, you get a Hamiltonian of this sort, where the energy splitting between spin up and spin down depends on the velocity of the dark matter relative to the quantization axis of the spins. This effect is therefore modulated as you change the magnetic field orientation relative to the axion dark matter direction. Which in the simplest case, you can do simply by letting the Earth rotate relative to the dark matter wind. Although presumably if you did see a signal, you would need to figure out a way to change the magnetic field direction yourself to separate it from other daily signals. So this is the dark matter signal in a little bit more detail. This is that daily effect that I was discussing. And then the signal is also oscillating at the Compton frequency of the axion. So you're going to be looking for an oscillation in the spin precession frequencies at the Compton frequency. That is doubly modulated by the modulation of your magnetic field relative to the axion dark matter. And then as the waves interfere with each other, you get some sort of stochastic modulation of it on top of that. And taking this into account correctly actually makes a big difference in your dark matter analysis. This is work that I did with Mariangela Lasanti and Matt Michella. Basically, while the Earth is moving through the dark matter, the dark matter is effectively stationary in the universe, and as the Earth is moving through it, there's an average velocity caused by the Earth. These stochastic effects mean that the instantaneous axion velocity direction is not really known. And so you need to do a likelihood analysis over the unknown axion velocity direction in order to do this analysis correctly. And so several previous analyses took their dark matter models to be sort of well known that it was along the direction of the Earth's motion, and that in fact you could very easily miss a dark matter signal if you make that assumption. So here is an analysis that we have nearly completed. This is using a data set taken by Mike Romalis, where he was comparing a potassium electron with a helium-3 nucleus. And this is one of the best co-magnetometer data sets that has been taken. And analyzing it using this likelihood method. These are the constraints that we arrived at. And so you can see over a little bit more than a decade of parameter space, we set limits that are better than the best limit from the supernova 1987A. No. Sorry, a decade of parameter space.
Ah.
Yeah, this is like two months of data.
2 months of data.
Yeah.
That's
very good. Yeah. I mean, I do have a different analysis that was a decade of data, but that doesn't beat supernova. That doesn't beat supernova 1980s. I mean,
does this sort of scale in the sort of naive way where if I increase the data by a factor of 10, my precision goes square root of that or something? Is that sort of roughly still the same? So like more data is the usual kind of
yes.
Scaling?
Yes, that is basically correct. At the lower frequencies, you can do a little bit better. You can do a coherent analysis until you hit those stochastic fluctuations of the axion.
Does the signal go as, I'm not familiar with these. Does the signal go with linear with the axion coupling or quadratic with the axion coupling?
Linear.
So if I increase my exposure by a factor of 100, my coupling limit should go down by a factor of 10, kind of.
That depends a little bit on what the axion Compton frequency is compared to the duration of the data set.
Oh, so you saturate at some point.
Well, so basically, if you're measuring a coherent oscillating signal, your constraint gets better linearly with the exposure, because you can sort of coherently track the phase of the signal. But that gets ruined once you get to this stochastic scenario, because now your phase is sort of getting perturbed by these interference effects. So basically, you are linear from when you start until you get to the stochastic fluctuations, you have linear exposure, and then after that it becomes square root. And so
there isn't a way to look for a sort of, because at the end of the day, the stochastic exposure, it sort of modulates the coherent oscillation with like a sort of a drift almost, you know, over time. So there's no way to follow that drift, or would that just,
well, because you don't know what the drift is going to be. And so you just have to leave it as a, yeah, exactly. So you just have to leave it as essentially a free parameter that gets, and so basically the point of that is that rollover in this data set like comes around here, let's say. So I think you would still be able to get a little bit of linear improvement right here for another factor of 2 or so. After that, it'll become quadratic. And then at lower masses, that happens later. So you could go a little bit further here. Up here, you're already into the regime where it's only square root. So one thing that made this analysis so tricky is that we were sort of crossing those three different regimes in the same data set. This stuff here?
Yeah.
That was the air. Okay, yeah. So this is probably the air conditioner. And like, it's so, you know, in the first month it was there, and the second month it wasn't there.
Okay.
Then this stuff that's very periodic, this is coming at sort of exactly 1 hertz. There was like a microcontroller that had like a 1 hertz electronic thing. So, you know, Mike was trying to do an experiment right here. So as long as he didn't see any spikes, he didn't care. And so he didn't bother like trying to clean up his DAC to like get rid of this microcontroller.
Like, electrical circuits are like 60 hertz, because it's what's coming from.
That's right, you know, and we don't go up to 60 hertz, but that's right. But this one is actually at very, very close to exactly 1 hertz. And there was a microcontroller in the DAC that's kind of like, you know, the little clock that's kind of like ticking along. So, you know, you probably like, you know. That's right. I can show you some other plots where we kind of did very detailed analyses of there of the exact line shape.
I see.
So you have. Yeah. Well, you know. So first of all, if it like existed only in one of the 2 months, we didn't really bother doing the line shape analysis, and so then we were left over with something like 10 of these. You know, we already weren't really worried about them because they were so like periodic and integer multiples of a hertz, but also we looked at the line shapes and they didn't really match exactly the axion line shape. It's 1/3 months in frequency units.
So you use your integration time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's why it's assumed that it was like a problem with the air conditioner. That's why they think it was the air conditioner turned off or fixed. Well, they fixed it, or they just turned it off for that month because they thought it was annoying. Yeah, they wanted better data. Yeah, I mean, that is a problem. It's very hard to know what the super local substructure is of dark matter. These things where you say this dark matter come and go, you know, I think people don't even really know. So there would be a small annual modulation of the signal. No, because you're not going for, because we're not going for a whole year, and B, actually the 2 months over which it occurred are near the turning point of the annual modulation. Yes. Yeah. So if you took data for a year, there would be a annual modulation that's like 10% or something. We did not. Yeah, you would need to do a correlated analysis to try to do that.
So in the annual modulation, the density doesn't change by that much.
The velocity, does, right? Yeah.
So you do take into account the fact that we're moving at a preferred velocity relative to that matter?
In our analysis, yes. Yes. That's right. So there's the preferred direction of the sun's motion, then there's also the stochastic interference effect. Those are both included in the analysis.
The spread in that stochastic model, was that by sort of take the error bars on what we know our city, the galaxy to be, or where is the spread there you're coming from?
Oh, what do we take as the...
Like you said, you know, other groups had just assumed like early fixed dark matter model. Standard thing to do, but you incorporated like actually I assume the error bars on what the velocity spread is and measurements. Is that what it was?
Well, we include the fact that the dark matter is an interference of many different modes, which each mode itself has its own velocity, it's going in its own direction, and so at the time of the experiment they're interfering in some specific way. And so then the spread, we take the spread basically to be the virial velocity of the galaxy. Okay, we have another, I did another experiment when I was at Princeton. This is more similar to the spin exchange optical pumping that I was discussing. Here we were doing neon and helium 3, a comparison between neon and helium 3. This is largely because the xenon-rubidium interaction is too strong, and so neon has a smaller rubidium interaction. Even so, in this experiment, we're not freezing the rubidium. It is still in the cell during the whole measurement cycle, and we're applying depolarizing RF fields to the rubidium during the course of the measurement. So in this case, you start the spin precession, you measure it for 100 seconds or something, you turn off your lasers and you start your depolarizing fields to eliminate the rubidium back interactions. And then you measure again after a dark period and you infer the frequency of precession during the dark by the measured phase at the end of the first measurement period and the phase at the beginning of the second measurement period. So from this, we had 30 days of data. And this is the amplitude of the sine wave and cosine wave over those days of data, as we sort of ran it in different experimental configurations. The signal of a dark matter signal will be that one or the other of these, that one or the other of these would be sort of significantly off from zero. And so since they're both consistent with zero, there's no dark matter signal in this data either. The x-axis, these are the different data sets that I was including in the measurement, because I was sort of taking data, doing some systematic tests, doing upgrades to the experiment. So these are, it's 30 days of data, but they're not consecutive. So this would tell you which day it was if you knew what the starting point was. Various days over the course of 2020. Okay, so in that data set, we are able to get pretty much match the supernova 1987A bound. And this is now in the fuzzy dark matter limit where the stability is much more difficult because you need to be stable for an entire day per measurement because it's much lower frequency. And so just for comparison, estimates of atom interferometer projected sensitivity you know, this existing data is already as good as 1 year of a 10 second atom interferometer, you know, and this is data that we have in hand that we can analyze. And even sort of a space-based one is only maybe a factor of 10 better than what we've done. Okay, so another thing that's interesting to study when you have a lot of polarized nuclei is CP violation. In particular, if there's an intrinsic electric dipole moment, that would be indicative of CP violation. And in this case, the precession frequency of the nuclei is changed by an electric field applied to the cell. So we tried doing this in Germany in 2019. In this experiment, it was helium and xenon polarized in a separate station, transferred into a measurement cell, and the sort of rubidium is, the rubidium kind of doesn't make it into the transfer because it collects in the pipes along the way. This is sort of what the raw data looks like. These large drifts are drifts in the squid offset, and here's sort of a frequency spectrum of that, with your xenon signal being here and your helium-3 signal being there. So that's how you separate them in the analysis. That's what you're asking about, this one?
Yeah.
That. So this very slow drift is at like millihertz or something, and that's because the squid itself is drifting. This 10 hertz thing is because, okay, so your squid is sitting here on like a table, and there's a magnetic field being applied in this direction, and so like when the table wobbles, the angle of the squid relative to the magnetic field changes, and like that was one of the vibrational frequencies of that table. Okay, so you know those low frequency things aren't really a huge deal when you're as long as your precession frequencies are above them. And so we sort of take a data set for several thousand seconds and alternate the electric field that's applied over the course of the data set. This now is the comagnetometer frequency. So here we've subtracted out magnetic field drifts by taking the difference between the helium and xenon precession frequencies. And we see that frequency itself is changing over time, which is why we have to alternate the electric field every few hundred seconds. And this, so basically this frequency decoherence is what limits the measurement sensitivity. Okay, so here's a systematic chart, which I can tell you guys about, but maybe it's not the most interesting.
Can I ask
Yeah.
you, so you may have said it in the how many atoms in
the field? This is going to be in the ballpark of 10 to the 19. For a cell of this size, six orders of magnitude.
I see.
That's the main limitation. That's the main limitation of this measurement. If you got rid of this drift, we could have done about a factor of 20 better in this data set. Then it comes down to things like, you know, if you're having drifts like that, you don't really try so hard to get all of your other experimental parameters perfect, because who cares if you just measure your drift a little bit better? So for instance, these like squid noises, that's a factor of 50 better, worse than the best squid that's ever been built. I actually am not sure that you would, in a system like this, it would probably be pretty hard to see the standard quantum limit, because your number of particles is so big. You would really probably have to need a revolution in squid and magnetic field noise.
Oh,
Yeah, you can. Then you would be 6 orders of magnitude better. I'll make an argument that I think that 5 orders of magnitude might actually be achievable.
Wow, that's cool.
It's getting close, yeah. The thing is, of course, you know, like if you really got to the standard quantum limit, you'd like make your cell a little bit bigger and increase your n. So then n over square root of n gets better. So, you know, I don't really know that you would have to do a squeezed state kind of thing for this sort of experiment. It would be hard. You know, you have like a lot of constraints on the magnetic field gradients and the noise of all your noise sources.
Just to explain, go back to the two figures with the co-magnetometer. Yeah, this one. We can explain again. So the top figure is.
This is the data after, you know, a low high pass filter applied, so the drifts are taken out. And this and the black line is the electric field that's being applied at that specific time.
So what's the second panel on the way?
This is the co-magnetometer frequency. So that means the xenon frequency minus the helium frequency scaled by their diamagnetic ratios. So this is supposed to
that's the signal.
That's right. That's the signal channel. That's supposed to not have any effects from magnetic fields. And then, you know, an electric dipole moment would basically, in a perfect scenario, you know, if this wasn't drifting, electric dipole moment would be that this would, you know, go down when you have a negative electric field and up when you have a positive. And, you know, we have to have this sort of complicated pattern of flipping the electric field so that this long drift doesn't.
So the drift is like is an imperfection, a systematic imperfection in the experiment, right?
Yeah, that's right. We think that we do. And we think it's coming from nonlinear interactions among the nuclear spins themselves. So here's an example of a data set that I took where this is this data that was a combination of helium, neon, and xenon. And here what I was doing is when I do the state initialization, the helium and neon were going direct as well as I could into the spin up, spin down superposition. The neon I was putting into various different superpositions at different angles. And so you can see, you know, if I had the neon be more spin up than spin down, you can see that the precession frequency is changing as I do that. So that's to say that the superposition of the nuclei affects what their precession frequency is. And then this leads to instabilities basically in two ways. I guess I did not put, thought I had added that slide. We may stumble across another slide later, we'll see. But basically you try to be in the perfect spin up, spin down superposition, but you don't necessarily get there because of imperfections in your control fields. And maybe we don't exactly know why, but there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't be perfect. Then as the nuclear spin polarization decays due to collisions with the walls and so on, that spin term is changing in magnitude. And so that is believed to be the source of this drift. And so, you know, that's also why it levels off after, you know, most of the nuclear spin is decayed, et cetera. There's a variety of like other indications beyond this that suggest that that's what it is.
So,
okay, I'll show it to you after.
If you change the pressure, like the strength of this term is going to change, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. If you change how polarized it is, that will change. That's right. And this also is a limitation because from one measurement to the next, your control fields have some fluctuations. And so, you know, this effect is different from one measurement to another. That's right. So this is sort of what I was saying, that this state to state transition, going from the optically pumped state into the superposition state, doing that as well as you possibly can is basically essential for trying to get this measurement better. And so this is a project that I've been talking to. That sort of thing is something that chemists have done a lot of. And so Victor Batista at Yale and Herschel Rabbits at Princeton are both interested in this project, is to try to design sort of what in the quantum control language is sort of optimal and robust control over the two nuclear spins at the same time. So the idea is picking a control field where an error in the control field amplitude or timing is you can quadratically or suppress its effect on the state initialization, the error in the state initialization. So that's something that we're trying to work on now, and it should be pretty interesting.
Super question. Like, do you need to do these two sample sets in the same location always?
The two different nuclei?
Yeah.
They don't absolutely have to be co-located. Of course, being co-located means that you're not as sensitive to magnetic field gradients. So if your two samples are next to each other, you know, you're sensitive to drifts in the magnetic gradient.
Like when you are.
Oh, you mean, could you prepare the helium in one chamber and the xenon in another, and then mix them? Definitely, you could. And that might be the best way to have very high polarizations of both. It's possible. Yeah, so then another thing that's interesting in quantum control, I don't know if this will work in a precision measurement, is there's something called dynamical decoupling, where you apply rapid sequences of inversion pulses to cancel unwanted terms in your Hamiltonian while hopefully preserving the term that you want. So, you know, the simplest example of this is just a spin echo if you're trying to cancel magnetic field gradients, but you would need more complicated pulses to cancel this nuclear spin interaction. I don't know, possibly applying this large number of pulses sort of just makes things worse from a just experimental standpoint.
How do you that? Does it depend on the interaction? I see you have 5, 6, plus 5. Does it go to 5?
Oh, so these are.
This is the pulse
sequence. Right. So these would be pulse sequences. So 5 would be some axis that you were going around. Yeah, so you know, this is not necessarily the sequence that you would need to cancel the pair of nuclear spin interactions. That's something that we're sort of trying to work out now. How physically large?
Yeah, physically or numbers.
I mean, yeah, I would definitely would try it on the cell. I would be more worried that errors in the spin echo pulses themselves would add additional noise back into my system. So I think that for now, I'm viewing that as like a quantum control project, just to see, can we do it on this 10 to the 19 atom sample? You know, if it works, then maybe you try to figure out how to do it while also maintaining your precision. So I think, you know, the quantum control is probably is more promising, because that's all just how you prepare your state. You do that at the beginning, and then the rest of the experiment proceeds in the same way. Okay, so these are sort of examples of kinds of pulses that are somewhat error correcting that still drive both spins to the same place. There are sort of numerically challenging problem. But they're sort of pretty sophisticated codes that people have developed to find these pulses. And then this is the pulse sequence that would cancel the helium xenon interaction. And the pulse sequence that cancels the xenon xenon interaction is not, I don't know what that is yet. Okay, so these nonlinear interactions that I mentioned, these are the same ones that you could use to generate a squeeze state if you wanted to. And I think that you probably, in a different configuration, might actually be able to measure this effect. I don't know whether it would be useful for a precision measurement. Okay, so
the spin-spin interaction, interaction or is it a collision term?
It is both. It comes from both.
There's you don't know what K naught is or kappa naught is a priori.
Right, so there are two terms. So there's three terms. There's the generic dipole interaction, which is just a static magnetic field, and that's canceled by the comagnetometer. Then there's a collisional term, which is not canceled by the comagnetometer, and a priori you don't know what it is, but you can measure it, so now we know what it is. And then there's a co-rotating magnetic dipole interaction, which depends on the shape of the cell, which is not canceled by the comagnetometer. And so in fact, one thing you can do is if you pick the temperature of your cell and the shape of it, you can have the dipole, you can pick the sign of the dipole interaction based on, you know, if you're like a little bit more pancaked or a little more elongated, and there's sort of a specific shape where the dipole term and the collisional term are equal. And so that could be another way to try to reduce this effect with sort of manufacturing these cells with a sort of a very specific geometry, which is a little bit of a, like, it's like a glass blowing challenge, and the glass blowers keep retiring. So I got to get it done soon. Okay, so this is the apparatus that I'm building now at Arizona State. And the idea is that instead of using a magnetically shielded room, we have a small set of shields that encloses the measurement volume, along with access holes for the squid cryostat and for the optical pumping system. And so in this way, the whole thing is sort of more compact and more repeatable, because you don't have to open and close your system and transfer the cells in and out. So it'll be sort of fully closed cycle liquid helium handling. The spin exchange optical pumping happens in situ, and then you freeze the rubidium to eliminate the rubidium back interactions. And then another thing this is that we are going to build it tilted by 30 degrees so that the magnetic field is aligned along the Earth's rotation axis, because there's a gyroscopic effect. There's a gyroscopic effect since the Earth is rotating and we're measuring the precession of the nuclear spins. There's a shift of 10 to the minus 5 hertz that depends on how aligned the magnetic field is, the relative alignment of magnetic field and the Earth's rotation axis. And so as there are small fluctuations in the magnetic field direction, that would also produce a frequency instability. So I think you can do about a factor of 10 better than current measurements without having to build it on a hill. But if you're going to do better than that, you need to align your experiment with the Earth's rotation axis. So you get a quadratic suppression of this effect. And then, you know, we'll try to build one of these sort of well-controlled cells and do some precision quantum state initialization. And hopefully we can do a lot better than previous measurements. So one other thing is that this is the lab that's under construction at ASU. And so, you know, the helium liquefaction is on a separate slab from the squid system and so on to isolate vibrations. And so we've ordered most of this equipment. A lot of the design is underway. So, you know, it's kind of sort of geometrically optimizing the coupling of the nuclei into the squids and the magnetic field noise and so on. It sounds like fairly mundane. Okay, you make some curve and you go to the high point. But sort of in reality, these layouts that we have done should give us a factor of 35 improvement in signal-to-noise ratio over the experiments done a couple of years ago. So the detailed modeling does pay off. So this is a 35 improvement in signal-to-noise ratio that, if you also have the perfect state initialization, you have another factor of 20 from that. And so this is where we're looking at close to a factor of 1,000. Improvement in total potential. Okay, so to get these very long lifetimes, you have to have the the main source of decoherence of the nuclei are magnetic field gradients in the cell. And while a compact geometry is advantageous for the state initialization, it's disadvantageous for magnetic field gradients. So we think we have a magnetic coil geometry that should meet the gradient requirements over centimeter size. And so that's where, you know, okay, if you go, the sensitivity, your dependence on the gradients goes quadratically with the size of the cell. So you could go to a bigger cell and your constraint on the gradients becomes that much harder. So basically the experiment that we are building, the design parameters are such that we do 1,000 times better than the most recent xenon EDM experiment, which is or 100 times better than the most recent, than this Otto Tesla experiment of Mike's, which probably we're hoping to get to in sort of two generations of these experiments. However, if you just look at what's the best squid that somebody's built and the best nuclear spin lifetimes and best polarizations, so you don't have to assume any other technical advances, you could do something like 5 orders of magnitude improvement, which then really just comes down to, can you do this state initialization sufficiently well to be to not be limited by drifts?
The new setup you built at ASU, should it get to the next?
The setup that I'm building is designed to be able to reach this one, but you probably can't do it in the first time you turn it on.
Yeah, I think.
But it's designed, you know, I don't have to build it again to get there. So this one, I have to build it, and then I'm assuming that I can get a sort of a factor of a little over 10 in the first measurement. So let's call this one like 5 years, and then this one 8 years, something like that. This, you would have to build the system again in a bigger apparatus and a lower noise squid, et cetera. So, you know, maybe you like start chipping away at some of those things now, you know, sort of in some sense, there'd be no point in doing all the expenditures required for one of these if like you can't get to these. It would start to get expensive. It'd start to be like you wouldn't be able to do it in that little chamber. But you don't need to assume any technical advances on the magnetometry side or the optical pumping. Okay, so one project that I've always liked is trying to search for the exchange of a pseudo-Goldstone boson, a dipole-dipole, or a monopole-dipole, which is not included, but we should discuss. So this was a spin-spin interaction between two polarized sources. And there has been some new developments in generating these, in generating very high spin density sources. And this is led by people who are building neutron spin filters at for beamlines. And so they do is they have a naphthalene crystal, and they sort of carefully put the correct amount of pentosine in it, and they can polarize the electron. The pentosines have some optically accessible electrons, which can be polarized using a laser, and then by sweeping a microwave field across it, the electron polarization is transferred to the protons. And so this is some data from of theirs from a few years ago, where they got 75% polarization of the protons, and you know, relaxation times in the hundreds of hours at sort of modest magnetic fields and liquid nitrogen temperatures. So if you could put one of these sort of super high density spin sources right up next to your co-magnetometer and tune out the gradient so you still had good lifetimes, a priori, you could get a factor, you could do better on the dipole-dipole tests by, you know, a factor of 10 to the 3 that we're assuming from the improved detector. And then you could get another factor of 10 to the 3 from having your source very close and the very high spin density. which would then be putting this sort of in the ballpark of constraints from solar cooling, let's say. Okay, that was everything that I had to say.
Questions? More questions?
So how does the sensitivity from the xenon nucleus compare to, say, the mercury nucleus? If you get an enhancement, was it the same EDM or?
Yes, so
magnitude.
Right. So your sensitivity, so the mercury is something like a factor of, is 8 times more sensitive to theta QCD for the same EDM sensitivity. But then there are the CP violation in pions, for instance, where they have sort of the same comparable sensitivities. So I'd say more or less, once you start getting into the ballpark of the, oh, sorry, that's a typo. That should be 10 to the minus 28. Sorry about that typo there. So, you know, I would say that the next generation version, probably if it's a factor of a few behind the mercury, that is seriously testing sources of CP violation that have not been tested before, since there can be different high energy sources.
Anyone else? Not, we can thank them again.